Hello and welcome to the CAAV podcast. The focus of today's episode is on the future direction of Scottish agricultural policy, a direction which is substantially driven by climate change, biodiversity and environmental objectives. Here with me to unpick the detail is Jeremy Moody, Secretary and Advisor to the CAAV. Welcome, Jeremy. Great to have you once again on the podcast. To start, perhaps you can explain to us where exactly are we now with regards to the latest policy developments?
Well, we now have the consultation paper from the Scottish Government about the forthcoming agriculture bill for its future agricultural policies for Scotland. We are coming towards the end of the first post-Brexit period in Scotland, which they called Stability and Simplicity, which was when, with some marginal changes to the inherited CAP, very much not a lot happened, but a lot of working groups met and talked to consider and make proposals on policy. A number of significant changes were made to inherited legislation around its operation, and also around the reversal of the European Union's desire to be rid of the less favoured area support scheme for beef and sheep. And those payments were brought back. But in principle, it's been a period where not a lot has happened. And people have been waiting to see what is going to happen after 2024. And we now have this consultation paper for the agriculture bill intended for next year, and an agriculture bill that is meant to be seen as part of a larger package of other pieces of legislation, including a land reform bill. There's a Good Food Nation bill that is just waiting for royal assent. We're waiting on a natural environment bill, which will come with environmental targets. And then for those parts of Scotland that are affected, a crofting bill. And this is looking to be quite a comprehensive package of measures bearing on agriculture and rural land management for the coming years, and driven, as you say, very heavily by climate change objectives.
And how would you describe the policy direction, picking up on that last point, and to what extent will climate change frame policies going forward?
It's virtually absolute, the extent to which it frames this. Agriculture has been asked by the Scottish Government over the last couple of years or so to prepare for a future that is written in pretty express climate change terms. This was summarised in the Vision for Scottish Agriculture paper issued in March, where they talked about the need for cultural change. We have the minister here talking in opening this paper, right in her preface, saying, "We are committed to tackling the climate and biodiversity crises and reaching net zero by 2045. Our agriculture sector has an indispensable role to play as we address these challenges. We should not shy away from being clear that we are on a journey of significant transformation." Now, in that, it wants agriculture to make that change, but it wants it to do so as an efficient industry, delivering on the emissions reductions targets, but also on its economic performance. This is a very big, big challenge. And quite simply, again, the introduction says, "Land management in Scotland will change as we tackle the twin climate and biodiversity crises, which will present challenges and opportunities." So it's being said in very plain words, right in front of people's noses, this is what is driving policy. Agriculture is to adapt to this, to the new world. And to some extent, of course, it's a new world in which climate change has effects in flooding and in drought and more extreme weather conditions. There are requirements on the industry to mitigate change, reducing emissions, but also to have to adapt to it. And the Scottish Government's proposals are very focused on this and are now yoking that with biodiversity, beginning to come towards the fore as an ally of climate change in all of this, expecting species recovery, nature recovery coming through, nature restoration, the kinds of phrases being used. And these frame policy.
And what's the precise target that agriculture needs to meet with regards to reducing its emissions?
Well, this was most recently described in the climate change plan update to 2032. Again, we're expecting more revisions of this to come through. But that has specified, and this is something over a year ago now, that agriculture should achieve a 31% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, methane, by 2032. That's for agriculture. I think it's worth noting, and the paper does just allude to this, that there is a separate head for reducing emissions called land use change and forestry. So this might be about peatland restoration, it might be about more trees, about other changes in use of land. And that's a separate target from that set for agriculture. And that could mean, therefore, that for businesses occupying rural land, they may actually have to meet more than a 31% target in the coming 10 years.
And this is all about reducing emissions. It doesn't take into consideration any sequestration.
That may well come with land use and land use change. That is the point about, can you sequester if forestry is being used for sequestration, which is a separate question. Certainly, reducing emissions and ideally sequestering in peatland, the other ways in which sequestration might happen, I think that is more likely to be within the land use change heading. But it becomes an interesting question when you start looking at how you might argue and show the extent to which, for example, grazing pasture may be a form of sequestration. There's work to be done around this, but I think the simple point at the moment is the scale of the challenge. There is not yet an understanding of how those targets are going to be met.
And it's not only the scale of the challenge, it's the urgency as well. 2032 is not that far away.
No, it's not. And in this context, the Scottish Government responded to the farmer-led groups and their proposals from spring last year by saying that the measures they'd come forward with, which were largely around these questions, would deliver 12% of the 31%, leaving the majority, another 19%, to be found by ways which we know not yet. And then you have the extra to be found, and that's in 10 years. And over and above that, there is the simple point that Scotland's net zero target is 2045. The earlier you start, the more you can plan, the more you can phase your way there, the easier and cheaper this job becomes. If we leave it till later, it becomes more abrupt, more of a shock, and with more adverse effects on people's businesses, particularly perhaps the livestock farming businesses that predominate in Scotland.
Now, let's turn our attention to some of the content of the consultation, and in particular, the proposed structure for conditional payments. Talk us through what's been suggested here.
Well, just to start, the paper is dominated by how you recast future payments policy, but it also has proposals for changes in tenancy law and a proposal around changing the basis for agricultural wages in Scotland. But the great weight of the paper is around how it would change subsidy policy. It's around a commitment that was in the programme for government and in the Bute House agreement between the Scottish Government and the Green Party to make half of payments conditional. And those agreements actually pointed it to being by 2025. I don't think that figure is actually quoted in this paper, but there's clearly that intention that payments become conditional. So the structure that they're adopting is to take the present pool of CAP payments, so basic payment, greening, LFAS, and the others, and recast them into four tiers. And tiers one and two appear to take half the pot of money, so possibly just a bit less than the present basic payment seems to take. And those two tiers will deal with this as a basic tier one, which could look quite like the present basic payment, but with a requirement for a whole farm plan with a whole lot of declarations and commitments around carbon, around habitats, around a variety of social objectives, around animal health and welfare, definitely requiring a business plan, a land management plan, and biodiversity and carbon audits. And that would be the probably, subject to how cross-compliance and greening might develop, probably that whole farm plan aspect is likely to be the largest change over and above where people are with the existing basic payment. But that will only be for a fraction of the current basic payment that people are used to having. We then go on to look at tier two. So that, if you like, is the other half of a slightly smaller basic payment, if we understand the proposals correctly. And that is looked at as an enhanced level direct payment. So it's still a payment directly to the farmer. It's there with more conditions around business efficiencies, around reducing emissions, and nature restoration and enhancement. And so here you see the top-up money, if you like, coming to get you near where basic payment has been, would look to be for now much more targeted changes in farming practice to make businesses better, to make them reduce their emissions, and to develop on biodiversity. And so those go quite a lot further. And that is, I think, the real force of the proposal of the Scottish Government to make half the current payments conditional. Then you come to the other half of the money. And those halves are indicated by a chart in the consultation paper. And tiers three and four will probably overlap a bit, but you have an elective payment that could be taken up. And that would, again, have more targeted. It might vary between areas. Some of this will be around knowledge and skills and training. Some of it will be around perhaps promoting organic or other forms of production and support for innovation. That could go, some of that money could go to people who aren't claiming under tiers one and two. But that could be for training. It could be for other matters. And then tier four, the complementary payment, is again around professional development for farming, so more of the knowledge, advisory services. Here you begin to see woodland and peatland restoration coming in. So for that extra payment, the current Agricultural Transformation Fund moved into it. And here you would have support for what we've known as LFAs, but which are now called areas of natural constraint. And there's talk of integrated land management around woodland and peatland restoration. This could be at a landscape level. It could be at a catchment level in places. There's a lot of flexibility around this. And these schemes are very likely to adapt as they're implemented. And it's under that tier four, and only under that tier four, is there any talk of any headage payment for any livestock. And that's a very tentative suggestion made. And that's quite striking when you consider the current structure of payments in less favoured areas in Scotland.
One of the omissions in this paper is that there is no information about payment rates. And given the scale of change required, do you think, is there any view in this paper expressed in relation to the scale of public money required to deliver these objectives?
No. The only indication we have within the paper is the chart that suggests that those first two tiers, the ones that look more like the basic payment but with a lot of extra demands, would be half the payment. And that's delivering on the political commitment that half of payments be conditional to farmers. Beyond that, and of course we're looking beyond 2024, and that is beyond the UK government's assurance that the money inherited from the CAP would be carried forward. Decisions then by the Scottish government, by the UK government around finance, the other pots of money that may or may not blend with this are all unknown at this stage. These are all matters for later parliaments. There is a larger picture, though, about finance, and it's an interesting one in the paper. Last year, the Green Finance Institute, which is a very serious and respectable body, doing a lot of analysis around how you might particularly begin to bear public and private finance on meeting climate change and other objectives, did an assessment for just the 2020s, just this decade, to say how far does funding fall short of the policy commitments that governments have made. And interestingly, for both England and Scotland, that figure was around, the core figure, and that was around 20 billion. And what is interesting is that the Scottish government is expressly affirming that figure in this paper and using that to talk about how it will need to draw in private finance as part of delivering on these larger objectives, of which these proposals are merely a part of Scotland reaching net zero by 2045. But in terms of Scottish population, that 20 billion is a very large shortfall. The honesty in recognising it is striking. and it illustrates the scale of change that is actually needed and being driven. And again, it's an affirmation of how this is really a climate change policy, but here delivering in agricultural terms.
Do you envisage publicly funded schemes existing alongside private contracts and working together?
I think that's likely. The Scottish Government has published some guidance on how it might see private finance involved, the scale of finance that particularly larger corporations can bring to bear, but of course smaller and private investors and others. And there's some interesting experimentation going on in some of these areas. The Bunloit estate is a well-known example, but there are others who are engaged in these activities. And these are very early and emerging markets. Some of it will happen anyway around perhaps the carbon markets might not have very much value in them, and people need to be quite careful about what they're entering into. The discussion of biodiversity may well lead us into more markets that could perhaps be more interesting. It's all very early days, but some of them will grow up naturally. Some of them may be things that are developed in conjunction with public policy.
What other matters within the paper do you think, Jeremy, is worth noting? I know there's mention of agricultural tenancy law. Anything in particular you'd like to highlight?
I think just before we get there, it's just worth picking up that this is a bill for Scotland's agricultural policy. So it provides for powers to deal with financial crises, incidents like foot and mouth. It provides powers for managing markets, intervening when necessary to ensure market balance on occasions. It provides powers around animal health, welfare and biosecurity and plant health, all of which are just part of the suite of powers that a government needs to have in order to operate an agricultural policy. And these have been features of UK agricultural policies, of European agricultural policies and so on, that just fairly standard. But it's worth picking up that this is then a more rounded agricultural policy, the important point being that agricultural policy is about more than payments. It's about managing the public policy for agriculture. And very much tenancy law fits into this. In all the great reforms, back whether in 1948 and 49 in Scotland, when we went through the same process, and this is really the first time Scotland's had a crack since then at doing this, because it's been in the European Union since 1973, it then brought in what became the Agricultural Holding Scotland Act. And now again, tenancy measures are on the table here. There are tenancy measures also out for consultation for the Land Reform Bill that we'll have next year. But here, the proposals are around some power for Scottish ministers to deem some kinds of diversification to be appropriate for tenants, such that whatever the lease says, those might be open to the tenant anyway, in tackling climate change and biodiversity questions. That then is supported by an extension of what might be compensatable improvements at WAGO. Scotland has a list of those improvements. So if an item's not on that list, it's not statutorily compensatable. That list was revised in January 2019 to catch up with a number of modern features of modern agriculture. That list would now be extendable to cover improvements that might deliver climate change or biodiversity gains. Of course, it's one thing for that an item to be on the list. It's another thing for whether it actually has any value at WAGO, but that's left for judgment in the circumstances at the time. There's a proposal which appears to be to set a timetable for not just how WAGO payments are to be negotiated or settled, but actually when they're to be finally resolved and paid. And that will be interesting to look at. There's provision, again, climate change, biodiversity driven, around the rules of good husbandry and sound estate management. And we wait to see how those might be recast to cover more than purely production ends. There's discussion around what the valuation might be where a landlord takes back part of a farm for, let's say, development. How is that paid for? That was last done in the late 1960s on a multiple of the rent, but we're in very different circumstances where it's very much harder to replace farmland. might there be a different valuation basis? That's left open as a question. Perhaps most strikingly is the proposal to replace the unimplemented rent review provisions of the 2016 Land Reform Act. Those have been found nearly impossible to implement, and new proposals have come forward for a rent review basis for the 1991 Act, which is geared around looking in essence at what people pay for other comparable tenancies, assessing the earnings potential that could come from a budget, and looking at what the economic outlook might be over the next 3 years. Those are non-exhaustive factors, but it provides a framework in which there is a balance that people can then find more readily. And in many ways, all rent reviews always boil down to, well, what are other people paying and what am I willing to pay? What do I think I can afford to pay for the next 3 years? And this is a way of articulating it. The 2016 measures were too dependent on a purely budgetary approach, with all the risks and strains and overemphasis that had. It wouldn't carry the strain. This looks to be a more realistic, a more practical way forward, and that is proposed in this paper.
And while this is an overarching paper in which there's a lot to digest and still a lot of detail to come, and while we await those details, what can a business do now today?
I think this is where it's always too easy to get distracted by the detail of public policy and look for it as though it's going to be the answer to an individual farmer's prayers. The real moral in all of this is for businesses to look to themselves, look to how they are going to be efficient, how they're going to be financially resilient, how to ensure that they are on top of the game in terms of the technical efficiency of the business, in terms of the finances of the business, the skills in the business. Where is that business going to go? Where does it want to be in 10 years' time? But looking to itself for its own resources as to how it's going to do this, then it can look at what public policy offers and whether it's useful, because there may be people for whom the new tiered structure is simply unattractive and they would rather farm without support. There will be other people for whom that support is going to be essential, but there is never a time when you should not be looking at getting the business right. Get the business right, get the management right, and then as the detail becomes clear, then it's possible to form sensible views around where this support that the Scottish Government is clearly intending, where it is helpful, what you might want to take up, how you might want to look at it, particularly around training, knowledge, innovation, those kinds of area, but also for the business to think about its greenhouse gas emissions, because for many businesses, the supply chain is going to make demands irrespective of whatever the Scottish Government does. Morrisons, the supermarket, is looking to have its supply chain, including food, net zero by 2030. That for beef is a massive challenge. That they're just starting to do it for eggs, that they're looking across the spread for this, is something that needs to be considered and thought about. Because if you're going to sell your produce well, you may need to meet these targets anyway.
Well, Jeremy, this has been a really useful summary of the position to date. A lot more detail to come, and I'm sure a lot more discussions to take place as well. CAAV members can, of course, gain access to a detailed briefing note on what's been discussed in today's podcast. It's available on the CAAV website. Jeremy Moody, Secretary and Advisor to the CAAV, thank you very much indeed.
And there we are. We've reached the end of yet another episode of the CAAV podcast. If you want to keep up to date with all future episodes, or indeed catch up on previous ones, please head to our website, or you can subscribe for free on whichever platform you use. Also, if you've got any feedback or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch by sending us an email to inquire@caav.org.uk. But that's it for today. Until the next time, thank you very much for listening, and bye for now.